Hello? Oh no, she's dead.
Death, a funny business on FUBAR Radio with Becky Briggs and Natasha Spencer-Levy.
Hi. It's all shits and giggles till somebody dies.
Hello.
Hello. Welcome back. Another week, another show.
Oh my god.
Death, funny business.
We're back, guys. All together.
All together.
Are you okay?
It's been a while since Tasha and I have been together.
Hi,
yeah,
guys.
It's been a while since we've been together.
We're back together in the studio, Becky and Tash, forever.
Ever.
Yeah.
Yeah. So you've been on the stage.
I've been treading the boards, guys.
I think you spoke about it last week, but...
Yeah, they all know.
They all know about it.
They know what's going on.
I went to go and watch you and it was fucking brilliant.
Well, thanks.
You made me cry.
Thanks, Becky. Was I convincing 13-year-old?
You were, but I did think you suited the prostitute more. I think that sort of...
I think, yeah. Yeah, do you know what? I think sex worker vibes, just, it really like, just, yeah, it brought something out of me. We had little fans and we were dancing around it. I think it really, I did feel something very visceral, you know, in the power of... In the power of it all. Look at you. What's wrong? Can you still not hear yourself?
No, do you know what? Could be honest. Pre-warning. I'm feeling really odd.
Yeah, you are. Can you tell them why? You can tell them why.
I was feeling a bit sick last week, so I started taking anti-nausea medication.
Well, because you went on a plane?
No, that's not why. I don't know why I felt sick.
Oh, you just felt poorly.
So I just thought I'd take some anti-nausea stuff.
Do you think it was all the Swedish food?
Swedish sweets. I've eaten too many sweets.
You've eaten too many, like, too much cream.
Probably cream and cheese and bread. To be honest, that's probably what it is. But I genuinely feel like something's happened to me. I feel like...
You did come in and I was a bit like, are you okay?
I feel really dazed. I feel really out of it. But anyway, we're going to continue.
Yeah, we totally are. I feel bizarre as well. So
what's wrong with you? You said you felt a bit depressed.
I'm just like having... Yeah, I'm having a bit of a depresso espresso.
Post-show blues.
Post-show blues. Also like just... I finished my job and I was like, what am I doing with my life? I need to get another job. I need to
Which mean you finished
job.
The job, the show
I
job.
Finished the show, yeah. And then I was like, okay, now what? And then I was like, I don't know what I'm doing in my life. I'm an actor. What do I do? Am I supposed to get a real job? Should I take a year out? Should I do a real job? Should I get a real job so that I can do a smaller, like, muggle job when I'm not working so that I can actually earn money and, like, have a life outside of doing little acting jobs? Or should I just... throw everything into acting and be like incredibly like unpaid and like just throw things at this and throw things at acting so that I like so that it's even though I have no idea, it's not like applying for a job. You don't apply for a job and you're like, okay, well, I'll send my CV and my I don't know, whatever. It's like, well, no, you have to do like this many tapes and you need to go to class and you need to go to workshop and you need to do all of these things. Mm. And none of them are like a definite step towards a job. They're just a thing that could help, but they might not help. But then it's like, you know, and then you're also like, and no one has any money. I can't do anything fun. I really want to get my hair cut.
Oh, you said that for ages.
No, I know. And I am going to get it done. I booked it anyway. And I'm just like, I'm going to take out a small loan, you know? No, I'm kidding.
Put on the credit card.
Like, I have a credit card. I don't have a credit card. I need to get a credit card.
Don't do it.
My granddad told me to get a credit card. He was like, you're wasting, you know, you're not doing it properly. You need to make sure that you're taking your credit score seriously and you need to put the credit card in.
As interesting as this is, I'm going to intro the show. do you want to intro the show?
Yeah, sure. I've done it all by myself.
You did it all by yourself last week.
So this week on the show, we have two guests. We have Hefsibar Kaplan, who is a registered art therapist and also a neo-humour therapist. He uses humour to provoke positive behavioural change, especially within grief. And we also have Dr. Tom Pelly, and he's a GP who's just released a book earlier this year for charity, and it's about his experience of grief and the loss of his brother, Matt, who died 6 years ago. And yeah,
we came in and you were reading the book, weren't you?
Yes, I've been reading the book. It's very well written, very interesting. And I'm a bit of a slow reader, so I didn't quite finish the last bit. But he writes very, what's the word? very vividly about the experience of grief. It's also it was also Mother's Day.
Well, I wanted to bring that up. Yeah,
which was rough.
How was Mother's Day?
It was okay.
For you,
I was sad that I couldn't be. I was working, so that's quite funny. Like being in the shop and you know people coming in to buy presents and being like, "You got any plans with your mum?" And I go, and I just I'm not an arsehole, so I just went. I went, no, not the moment. I'm sure we'll figure something out. Like, and this poor person was
have a nice day. Because we've discussed this before about lying. Sometimes it's just easier to lie.
No, because like, bless that person. Like, they was like my first customer of the day, and I literally turned to my shout out to coworker, literally like the first customer, turned to coworker Faye and was like, my bestie Faye, shout out Faye. She is a regular listener of this podcast, sweet baby angel. And I just looked at her and I was like, it's going to be a long day. I was like, it's going to be a long day. Well, and it was.
People just don't realise it, though. They don't think about the fact that, you know, there are mothers who, you know, can't have children. There are like, mothers, that doesn't make sense. There are people. No. There are women that can't have children. They can't be a mother when they want to be a mother.
Or mums who've lost babies. Exactly. And, like, aren't, well, like, don't have our mums, but don't
have a good
kids.
Relationship like, with your, you know, with your mother, or don't know your mother. So there are so many reasons why I think this day really pisses me off. Yeah. Also, just be, if you do have a mum, just try and be nice to her as much as possible.
Yeah, all the time.
Not just for that
But then,
day.
To be fair, we're a little bit biased. I did say on our story the other day, I think it is nice, like, in a way. I was like, that's the thing. That's why people say that to me. Why? Ooh, sorry. We have a window out here and I can see, like, little blossoms, like, blowing in the breeze. And it's so nice. Sorry, it looks like snow. Anyway, there's no ADHD in this room at all.
No.
None whatsoever.
No, we love and accept it.
What was I saying? No, I was going to say, it is really nice because there's a level of, like, people coming in and, like, there's lots of flowers and little gifts and whatever. And I think that's lovely. And I think that's why, specifically, that first customer was like, felt comfortable saying it because I was like, oh, that's so nice, you're getting it for your mum, like, la 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 la.
Yeah,
because I'm nice, I'm not a dick.
What would you do if you weren't working? What would you, how would you spend Mother's Day?
Well, I think, like, obviously that the goal is to, like, be with my sister and with my dad, probably, so I probably would have gone home, but I also, like, it's just tricky to get all the way down there and then come back. But also, like, it's also, is it important? Like, is it an important day? Not necessarily, but it's also just like, it's that kind
a reminder,
of like veil.
Isn't it? It's a reminder, and
it's like a little film over the experience of a day. But I think actually the kind of domino effect of it was more, I felt more on Monday of like having to kind of like, okay, Sunday's like chilling, I was in the garden, I was minding my own business. And then Sunday I was like, right, I need to sit down, I need to work, and I need to, like, do, like, admin, and I need to do job stuff, and I need to do acting stuff, and I need to do podcast stuff or whatever. And I was a bit like, I don't know what I'm doing, and I miss my mum, and I'm
those moments lost. Where you feel really overwhelmed and unsure about life and decisions and all these big things, that's just when you want to be with the person that's not there to be able to be like,
exactly,
so what do you think about this?
Precisely. That's why I called my sister. I just messaged my sister. She laughed. I was like, hello, was just wondering if you're available, if you are have the capacity to talk to me. I think I need to have a little bit of a rant. And she was like, yeah, duh, like, call me. She called me and she's like, what's wrong? And then I was like, I'm just like, I'm so nervous, you know, it's that's me crying.
She's
great.
That?
I mean, she's just like, why are you being an idiot? You have lots going on. Everything's okay. You know, you just done a job. Why are you freaking out? Like,
I think actually, yeah, she's got a point. You do need to just stop and reflect and go, I've just done this incredible show.
Why am I acting like I can't do it?
You've done it.
What am I
doing? Just sit and just enjoy the fact that you've done it and just be happy about that you've done it.
Fucking
and just go, do you know what? Yeah, I have done a good job and I'm proud of myself. I'm proud of you. So you take a moment and take a beat and go, Christ. I've done really fucking well.
Thank you. What? Fine, I will. Jesus.
I don't know where that came from.
But also, I think that's just, I mean, look, I'm in a very privileged position where I've chosen to be an actor and, like, I've chosen this life of, like, uncertainty. And I think it's just this thing where, for me, genuinely, every job I've had, I've just been like, well, that was lovely. I'll never act again because that was just luck. Like, I'm like, it's not like, you know, I was like, that was very nice, but it was nice while it lasted.
But I think that's just like fuel and ammunition for the next, for the next job or the next creative thing that you do, you know?
Of course. But you know, it is, it's just,
but you're grieving that.
It's the classic problem of like insecurity and like slight imposter syndrome, where I know I'm good at my job, I know I'm okay, like none of that is like a problem. It's just the subconscious thing that you're like, well, this is an awfully lucky thing I've done. I'll let you know, guess that'll be my last job. And it's like, no, you silly fuck, like shut up.
At least you can tell yourself that.
Yeah, but you know, you're subconscious, and like especially when you're feeling down, it's like, no, you're not gonna do it, are you? The little goblin in the back of your brain is like, why do you think you're going to have a job? You know? Why do you think you get nice things? You don't get nice things. Apparently, this is what my goblin sounds like.
I'm gonna have a chat to you after the show.
About what? My goblin?
Confidence.
Confidence. Mm. Hey, I talk to you about confidence all the time.
I know.
Maybe you need to give me the chat.
I do.
Yeah, go on.
Both need to be there for each other.
We do. Uh-huh. How have you been? How was Sweden?
Oh, Sweden was great.
Sweden was really nice.
I brought my boyfriend to meet my mother.
She has a boyfriend. Have we told people that? Oh, all right. She has a boyfriend.
That was nice. It was nice. I mean, it was a bit like a bit of a weird one in terms of, I don't know, like, you know, introing your partner to your mum, you know, and like dad's not there. That's a bit weird.
Yeah.
That's a bit like, wonder what he would have said. Yeah. Wonder what he would have thought of this new man in my life.
The new man. But also, it's tricky anyway to just introduce it to one parent.
Yeah. I think just boyfriends in general, like, kind of integrating and mingling into... They're just difficult.
It's just hard.
Stop. Yeah.
Just a nightmare.
10 days was enough.
10 days was enough.
I'm joking.
JK, love you, bye. Sorry.
No, but I think that was actually quite difficult in a way. Like, just kind of not... I think... Dad would have been quite honest about how he felt about him. He would have been like, oh, he's funny. Nah, not sure about that one, I think. Yeah. I think he just would have been a bit more honest. And I don't really know how my family, what they think about him.
I know what you mean. Like,
a bit more like,
I mean, when I've ever brought people home and whatever, like ex-partners, whatever, I've definitely been like, oh God, I wish Mum was here, because my dad, love you if you're listening, but Jesus, like he cannot pretend to entertain someone if he doesn't like it. Like one of my poor ex-boyfriends, oh my God, just no interest whatsoever, just like, why? And I'm like, I don't know, I like him. he's like
you don't have to date him,
I
dad
get it. My ex-girlfriend, though, bloody loved it. She played guitar, though. So he was like, my dad's a guitarist. So he's like, oh, Lou, isn't it very, very clever, isn't she? I was like, yeah, right, never mind. But yeah, they are difficult.
It's difficult. And there's no right or wrong. It's not like I'm like, oh, Mum, I wish she'd acted that way at all. She was amazing. I fucking loved how she was.
Course.
And she was the most amazing host and everything.
But
it's just
like a what if.
It's just a what if. And it's just another question of like, oh, okay, yeah, you're not here, but what would you have thought? And just, you know, those things arise. They always seem to arise, don't they?
They do.
Anyway...
Yeah.
We are going to have a guest in the studio after the break.
Are we?
Yes.
That's very exciting.
To discuss art therapist.
In person. I've had art therapy before.
You have?
Yeah.
Okay, save it.
All right.
Save it. See you after the break.
Bye.
Bye.
FUPAR Radio. Politics Uncensored.
First of all, Donald Trump can monumentally fuck off with these proposals. Let's call this what it is. What they are trying to do is take over 2 million people whose homes, families, heritage, generations, lineage, lives, futures, dreams, hopes are tied intrinsically to the land of Gaza and ethnically cleanse them into different regions.
You're listening to FUBAR Radio. Download our app now to listen to your favourite shows, such as Access All Areas, Politics Uncensored, and The Dating Show. You can also download and catch up on previous episodes of all FUBAR shows, including our box sets. Plus, you can get in touch directly from within the app. Just search for FUBAR Radio on the Apple and Google app stores. Yay! The FUBAR Radio app. Get it today.
Registering to vote means you can take part in the way decisions are made in the UK. When you register to vote, you are then able to cast your vote at local and national elections. You can help choose who runs your area and makes decisions about things you care about. Millions of people in the UK aren't registered to vote, and they miss out on having their voice heard. It's quick and easy to register. It only takes 5 minutes. You can do it online, or you can ask for a paper form at your local council. Register to vote now at gov.uk/register to vote.
I was fine on this beach the other day. I didn't know the time of high tide changes, and I had no idea it could come in so fast. So I'm finding out the hard way. From this fella, the Coast Guard, who dropped in to get me out.
Ready!
Before you go to the coast, check the tide times online. In an emergency, call 999 and ask for the Coast Guard.
That Money Show with Gabriel Nussbaum on FUBAR Radio.
So shall we start from the very beginning, if you're happy to explain a little bit more what this ISA product is in the first place?
Yeah, so an ISA stands for Individual Savings Account. And there are different versions of ISAs. You can have them for cash savings, so what most people probably come into interaction with them of. The reason they are important is because any growth you get on the money in that ISA, if you do that outside of an ISA, the tax man can take some of that.
What the Hell with George Bertineau on FUBAR Radio.
Joining me is going to be Lily White, content creator and founder of The Nightclub.
You're told to wear high vis, you're told to change your route weekly. They're so helpful and I'd always recommend them, but that's not solving the root of the problem.
No.
It's, again, a societal issue that needs to be corrected, and putting the onus on women all the time is not going to solve the problem.
Death, a Funny Business on FUBAR Radio with Becky Briggs and Natasha Spencer-Levy.
Welcome back to Death, a Funny Business.
Yes, we are back.
In the studio, we're joined with Hefzibah Kaplan. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, pleasure to be here.
Would you like to intro yourself so that we can... Do you want to intro yourself? So you're an art therapist and a neo-humour therapist, but we will be discussing neo-humour therapist. Yes. What is this?
Yeah. Okay.
So don't want to get it wrong.
That's fine. So art therapy, it's a state-registered profession in the UK. We work in many different clinical areas, from schools to hospitals to psychiatry to prisons to museums, you name it, where people might be in need, art therapists are available to work. As an art therapist, I sort of set up and run London Art Therapy Centre based in King's Cross, and we do lots of trainings, and I supervise many art therapists around the country. My particular interest, however, is in the use of humour to catalyse change. And this started around 1970s. So this is how the story of neo-humour came about. So we all know that humour is, laughter is good for the body.
Absolutely.
It's good for our muscles, it's good for our lungs, it's good for exercise, it activates endorphins, gabapentins, all that good stuff. Sip of water.
Yes, very important.
Or laughter, or you can make laughter.
That's our show, isn't it? Death of Funny Business.
Yeah, I was just thinking, humor isn't that the whole thing? Like, that's kind of our jam, which is to laugh ourselves to try and not cry.
Laugh at me as we go along. Anyway, so we know that laughter is good for the body. So then the question arose, can humor be used as an active agent in the mind to change something about our feelings? Additionally, when you're laughing, you're in an ideal psychophysiological state for shifts to happen internally, for things to be metabolized, grief, anger, etc. Yeah. So it's very exciting. So developed from the work of the 1970s by a bloke called Frank Farrelly, who developed something called provocative therapy, which essentially looks at using reverse psychology, paradoxical intention, et cetera, in therapy. There's a long backstory to him as well. studied with him, learned from him, attended lots of trainings. And then we go to this idea, well, what actually are we laughing at? And often there's this assumption that we're a single self. But actually, that is an assumption. If you look through history and theology and philosophy, literature, psychology, we've always been a multiplicity of selves. The part of ourselves that is like this, the part of ourselves is like that. So then we can start to unpack it a bit and think about the subself, maybe, and we call them the subselves, neo-humour, the subself perhaps that's too dominant, too acting out, as we call it in kind of therapy speak, too annoying perhaps. And the subself needs to be quietened down. Well, maybe the subself is just damaging themselves with over smoking, for example. They're over-smoking and they're damaging themselves. That's the sub-self. It might be damaging sub-self or the stubborn sub-self. So what we do is we use paradoxical intention and humour and reverse psychology and irony, never sarcasm, never invective, never to hurt, always with permission. And we use this to catalyse change in the person. And it's very powerful and very effective. So my husband and I, Dr. Brian Kaplan, we've been studying this, practicing this for many years, working with a whole range of clients and people, training. And so our book came out a couple of years ago. I brought you a copy. Aww. It's called Almost Happy. And we have now kind of looking at how humor can be used with ADHD. Because ADHD is a very funny presentation, actually. And people often think that people with ADHD are stubborn or it's an act of volition. It's not an act of volition. They can't help it. And it can be very funny sometimes.
Yes.
Or those superpowers and talents. So kind of this is what I do. So I've incorporated provocative therapy, the use of humor, conscience, sub-selves. And we've called this neo-humor. So this is what neo-humor is. Okay. It's humor that is therapeutically used with good intention, goodwill, and only ever with permission of the client.
That's fascinating. How does that look like in a session?
Okay. So there are a few of us who practice around the world. Jeannie practices in prisons, men's prisons in Australia.
Oh, wow.
Somebody else is practicing in a psychiatric hospital. A friend of mine is top practitioner in the country, psychiatric social worker. So I'm going to tell his story, and I have permission to tell this story because he teaches it. So kind of a patient comes in, a patient's often known who's always coming through the door, you know, the revolving door syndrome within the NHS, that not a lot of people get seen for long enough time for a proper recovery. So they're back again. And my friend has a consultation with her. He's a psychiatric social worker, very high tier. Mm. And she says, well, that's it. I'm going to do the deed. I'm going to do it. And he goes, he's trained with Frank. And he said, well, when are you going to do it? Because you let me know. She goes, why? You uncaring bastard. Why do you need to know? And he said, well, he picks up his big diary because it's pre-computer days. He's now retired. And he flicks through his diary and goes, because if I know you're not coming to the session next Wednesday, then I can allocate it to somebody else on my very long waiting list. She gets up. I've had enough of you and all the services. She's within very quickly, I don't know the accurate time frame, she's discharged. She lives a very good, healthy life. Mm. 7 years later, she knocks on his door and says, I'm being fine, but whatever you did to me last time, could you do it again? I've got a driving test tomorrow.
Wow. What on earth? That is wild. Do you think that, because it almost sounds like there's a possibility that could have had a negative impact.
Yeah.
Like that there's a fine line that we're walking here with humour and obviously people, but I suppose, is it about kind of analysing the person beforehand and knowing that they can take it, or?
Yeah, especially culturally, I'm just thinking, because I'm from Sweden and the humour is, like, my mum is Swedish and it's so different to how we would respond to things here. Like, sometimes I say things and it does not land. So I would be really worried about doing that to a Swedish person.
So it's bookended. Right. The process is bookended. It starts with my specialist interest, or I've had training in the use of humour. And if I think of something provocative, not to hurt you, but something that might be useful for your benefit, would you be open for it? And the client first gives permission. And then we do formal permission. Do I have your permission to be provocative, rude, scatological, eschatological, irreverent, sexist, misogynist, and politically incorrect? And people are going, please, get on with it. And then there's the question, well, in one situation, the story belongs to a colleague, not myself, and said, is there anything in that list you don't want? And the lady said, blasphemy.
Scatological humour, but no blasphemy.
Yeah.
Talk about poo all you want, but no blasphemy.
Yeah.
Do not take the Lord's name in vain. That's incredible. Did it work?
Oh, yes. Because we know in ourselves, you know, we have the answers in ourselves. When we use humour, we're trying to activate the voice of conscience, the voice that really knows what they need to do. So I can give you an example of smoking, for example.
Mm.
Somebody comes, I want to give up smoking. We're not smoking cessation experts. Mm. We can look at the psychoanalytic reasons why they're smoking and blah, 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 blah. Or we can kind of cut to the chase. So depending on the person, this is the answer to your question, do we analyze them? No. First of all, we need the permission. We need to understand them.
Okay.
We need to think about the capacity at which they can go. We need to not work with people who might be might have brain injury, who might be in unstable states of mind.
Mm.
So we will exclude certain people. Maybe someone's in a diabetic hypo or hyper or hypo and is rather prone to being labor, could be, not for everyone. Mm. We would be careful about that.
Mm.
So it's selected in that way.
Mm.
And then, so you start off with this sense of, well, what do you want? What would you like to achieve?
Mm.
So we have a bubble. So the first is conversation. And then the technique is kind of lots of questions and bombarding and whatever. And the person go, whoa, I was giving the example of smoking. So I'm going back to the smoking. But why do you want to give up? What's wrong with smoking?
Mm.
That's one of 40 provocative strategies. What's wrong with that? Mm. Another strategy might be do more of the same. You're only smoking 30 a day. Come back to me when you're on 80 a day. Another one might be tool number 4, whatever it is, starting tomorrow. Postpone making this decision. You're not yet ready to give up smoking. You know, you're a non-starter for everything. Why do you start with smoking? Another strategy might be connecting the person's sense of fear. Only give up when you sort of have your symptoms of emphysema. That's a good time to give up. So I've just given you examples of 5 strategies that many we could draw from. Huh? So we kind of think about the strategy that's appropriate to the person and we see it works. And then the person is activated and they go, oh, shit, this is ridiculous.
Mm.
This is absurd. Or he's onto something here. Mm. I like it.
This is fascinating. But this process, you know, I'm just thinking in like a therapy session, how long are we looking at? Are we to be able to witness that change?
Good question. So there's different formats for doing it. So I'm going to refer to my husband's practice and then I'll refer to my practice.
Mm.
We're very different. So he's a counselling doctor trained in this area.
Mm.
So in his practice, he might have one session where he gets to know the patient, first of all, gets a sense of what they're interested in, talks about humour, gets a back history on experiences of therapy. It's an assessment of some sort.
Mm.
The second session, he will go, okay, do I have your permission? Shall we do a 20-minute window? And then we'll have another 20, 40 minutes just to discuss it, reflect on it.
Mm.
And the third session might be a wrap-up session. So it can be very effective.
Mm.
So he sets up the container, the framework,
from
within a three-session package, for example. Package sounds a bit commercial. It's not like that. Okay, for me, I'm an art therapist. I'm working with people ongoing every week.
Mm.
It's quite serious business, but it's also funny business. I do hear stories of death. I was thinking about, stories from miscarriages to stillborn, to babies, to children, to adults, to partners, to illness, to end of life.
Mm.
I hear all those stories. So I am involved with those stories on a regular basis, plus everything else that's going on with people's lives that they need kind of stabilizing, regulating, being creative. And so if I think of something funny, I might remind a client, especially if I've been seeing them for a while and it's been quite kind of conventional in its format, I'll say, I just thought of something a bit funny. Can I kind of give it to you? So I ask permission in the moment.
Okay.
And then I will say something. I can give you an example.
Please.
I've seen a lady in her 50s. She had an intelligent lady, but she hadn't completed her education.
Mm.
She was living in social housing. She'd had rough history with a couple of men, a couple of grown-up kids.
Mm.
And she was really trying to monitor her alcohol. Anyway, she makes an image and I look at it and I go, you know, this image, it kind of reminds me a bit of town planning somehow. It's kind of a map of some sort. And she goes, I can't believe you said that. She said, my father, the beloved father who died 4 months earlier, My father used to love architecture. He used to take me all around London and point out buildings. And I know all about Courvoisier. And I thought, isn't Courvoisier brandy? Doesn't she mean Courbusier? And should I mention this to her? Will I risk shaming her? Or might it be okay? I thought, I'm going to take the risk. And I said, do you mean Courbusier? And she laughed. And we couldn't stop giggling for 10 minutes. It shifted something in the relationship as well.
Yeah.
I treated her with respect because I was able not to be condescending or superior about it. And that was just taking a humorous risk, seeing something from a different angle. That's one example.
So I never thought about that kind of dynamic between therapist and
client.
Or, you know, person. Because I think that I really respect my therapist when he's open and honest or shares something in his life, because it doesn't make it feel like it's the one with all the issues and he's here to save me. You know, there's this kind of just equal, and perhaps humour does bring that into the room. I think that's so interesting. And where does the art comes into play? You're also an art therapist. So do you want to talk about kind of what it is that happens in those rooms?
Well, people come into the art studio, child, young person, adult. They might be a regular client. They might be a trainee, someone in training. They might be another healthcare professional. But let's start from the very beginning. They're new. They walk into a studio and go, wow, art materials, paint, colours, how exciting. And we have a chat. We just check in about what they're looking for, what they want, what their history might be, or significant parts of their history, because it's all going to unpack not in a chronological order anyway, which is kind of what art does. You can put everything down in the image non-chronologically. Past, present, and future can coexist in a painting. And it's very exciting to see it all mapped out. In language, you've got to speak in order so everything makes sense. But in image, it doesn't need to make sense. So at a certain point, people might mention something. Maybe they want to explore family. Maybe there's something to do with illness. Maybe it's just a confused head and fragile state of mind. And they're invited to pick up the art materials. There's plenty nearby. There's plenty around the room. And just use them in any way they like. Some people are really hungry, greedy to start, passionate, want to throw everything in all at once. And other people might be more tentative and slow. I remember a journalist coming to work with me, and she said she wanted to free up her creativity. She was tired of kind of her day job. And she put her fingers, 10 fingers in 10 colours of paint, and she just typed on a piece of paper. And then after a few weeks, the paper got bigger and the strokes got bigger, and this is what she did.
Wow.
And you mentioned colours earlier, briefly, that they mean different emotions. They kind of are aligned with different emotions. Is that right? Or
well, I've got that completely in art therapy, we don't have a lexicon. We don't have a dictionary. The red means this and blue means that. And an X means something, whatever. We don't work like that. What is most true is what the image says to the client. Now, we might think about a different narrative or offer a different narrative. We see something else in the story, but we never impose a meaning. So in regard to colours, I was thinking about, so colours are very personal and how you use them and in what form you create them. But I was thinking about FUBAR Radio. I was thinking about death, a funny business. And I was thinking about, I wonder what colours might be used, because I know that obviously black is used, worn a lot in the West, and white is worn a lot in the East. But I wonder whether other colours from other cultures have had any bearing. So black clothes are worn in Western cultures, Europe, North America, Australia, and they tend to mean mourning, loss, and respect for the dead. It's associated with darkness, the unknown, symbolizing the absence of life and light. In China, India, Japan, Korea, Vietnam, white is worn, meaning purity, rebirth, the cycle of life and death. Source, I know it's ChatGPT, but source. In many Asian cultures, white is the colour of funerals, signifying the soul's transition rather than the end. Red, South Africa, Ghana, and some parts of China. Meaning, in South Africa, red is linked to mourning and political violence. In Ghana, red and black are funeral colours. In China, red can symbolise protection against evil spirits. Source, blood energy and the violent nature of death in some contexts. Shall I carry on?
Wow.
One more.
One more.
Okay, do you want blue, purple or grey?
Tash, you choose.
Purple.
Or yellow?
Purple.
Purple. Okay. Purple. Brazil, Thailand and Catholic traditions. Meaning, in Brazil, purple is the colour of mourning. In Thailand, widows wear purple. It is also used in Catholic mourning rituals. And the source means spirituality, penance and connection to the divine.
Mm. Fascinating.
That's so interesting. I'm really, really in love with this whole humour therapy.
I feel like it's our vibe.
It is our vibe. It's so brilliant. And just to wrap up, sorry, we've got to kind of move on, but is there a particular message or piece of like insight about grief or what it is that you do that you'd like to share with our listeners today?
I'd say that grief is usually embodied. It's not just in the mind. It's not in the thoughts. Mm. And an embodied approach, movement, dance, art, is a wonderful way to shift some of those feelings. However, the best of all is to use humour, not to deny the pain, but just to allow the pain to coexist with the kind of laughter and the love of life and hope.
Oh, that's so beautiful.
Perfect.
Thank you.
Wonderful. Thank you so much, Hezra.
Thank you so much for joining us today. We're going to head up to a break and then we're back with Dr. Tom Pelly to discuss his book and more about grief. See you soon.
FUBAR Radio. Access all areas with Bobby Norris.
We've just been joined in the studio by Miss Lacey. If you could give Nathan a message right now, what would it be?
I was there for you, whether you want to admit it or not. I was your backbone, I was your strength, and I would do it again. You know, we fell in love, and I would always pick you to marry you, you know, in that process. But say the truth. Mm. Put the trolls to bed. Mm-hmm.
You're listening to FUBAR Radio. Download our app now to listen to your favourite shows, such as Access All Areas, Politics Uncensored, and The Dating Show. You can also download and catch up on previous episodes of all FUBAR shows, including our box sets. Plus, you can get in touch directly from within the app. Just search for FUBAR Radio on the Apple and Google App Stores. Yeah. The FUBAR Radio app. Get it today. Get it today.
Some companies try to reel people in by promising quick cash if you pay them to claim work expenses. But think twice before taking the bait, because they might just want to land a commission, and it turns out you aren't eligible to claim anything. You'll have to pay HMRC back, and it's unlikely the company will refund any fees. So don't get caught out. Check if you're eligible and make a claim with HMRC for free online. Just search Don't Get Caught Out.
One in five people in the UK are disabled, and it's not always visible. So if we've made ourselves at home in priority spaces on the bus or train, surrounded by our shopping bags or bikes, we could be making it harder for the people who need that space more than us. So let's not forget about the people we share our journeys with, and keep priority spaces clear for others. Remember, it's everyone's journey.
Pulse of the Nation with Andrew White on FUBAR Radio.
The one, the only, Basil Brush.
Hello, 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 hello to all of FUBAR Radio.
Who's been the best person you've ever worked with, your favourite celeb encounter?
I mean, that's sort of the million-dollar question, isn't it? I mean, Kate, obviously.
Nick. Yeah, yeah.
Today, obviously. Kate, never worked with Kate before, but she is a legend, apparently.
I've been called better.
With orange socks, which I'm rather partial to, I've got to say.
Boom, boom! Politics Uncensored.
First of all, Donald Trump can monumentally fuck off with these proposals. Let's call this what it is. What they are trying to do is take over 2 million people whose homes, families, heritage, generations, lineage, lives, futures, dreams, hopes are tied intrinsically to the land of Gaza and ethnically cleanse them into different regions.
Death, a funny business on FUBAR Radio with Becky Briggs and Natasha Spencer-Levy.
We are back. Oh, we're back. Hello. I can't hear myself. There we go.
We're back.
Hezra, what a lovely, lovely human. And she's given us a copy of her book, Almost Happy. And I just wanted to read the first page. It says, please do not read this book if you don't have a sense of humour about your issues in your personal life or are more likely to be offended than abused. And
I think that is,
I mean, I'm going to very much enjoy reading this.
It's really colourful.
Yeah.
What's it called? Almost Happy.
And she's given us some little badges as well. So we're definitely going to be
And she also runs workshops, I think. So maybe Fubar can do a little story and tag her and all that stuff.
Put that on our stories and stuff.
Yeah.
But now, very excitingly, we have Dr. Tom Pelly on the Zoom.
We do.
And can you hear us, Tom?
I can hear you. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can hear you. How are you doing today?
Great. I'm very excited to be here. Thank you for having me.
Amazing. I've actually been thank you so much, by the way, for sending your book to us, Precipitous Life. I've been reading it and I've found it very, very moving. Obviously, the book talks about how your brother died, and normally on Death Funny Business, what we normally do if someone's lost a loved one, we normally ask what they were like. So if you wouldn't mind, and if you feel comfortable, we'd love to hear a bit about what your brother Matt was like, and if you want to talk to us about that.
Thank you. I feel suddenly overcome by challenge and emotion of not being able to sell my brother properly in a short beautiful way, but he was amazing, and he was the lifeblood of any party. He was the kind of guy that when you were connected to him made you feel like you were the only person in the room. He was somebody who had this aura around him, and he lived life to the full. He was also someone that was totally chaotic, and you know, it's also difficult talking about somebody after they've died, isn't it, because you don't want to do them down too much. But he was terrible, would suddenly appear on the doorstep on a Sunday saying, I've come for lunch, or would also on a Sunday ring up and say, oh, I'm still in London. Of course I'm not coming for lunch. You know, and he was just really very focused on the moment. And when you were in that space, it was a great place. He is hugely missed. And that's, I guess, why I felt like I needed to write something down about it. And why I think it's so important to be talking about it. So, as I say, so glad to be here to do that.
Oh, no, thank you so much. And I mean, straight away, let's talk about the book. It's a really visual, visceral description of what it's like to grieve. And I wonder if you could tell us a bit more about how the writing process was for you and how that was for your own grief journey, and if it helped at all or...
Yeah, I guess it felt like after Matt had died, probably a long period, a couple of years where it was difficult to do anything other than focus on myself and getting myself back to normal as much as you can do after somebody dies that you're close to. And I guess that it suddenly became clear to me that I felt like I needed to write something, and it felt like I'd learned something along the way that I really needed to get out there. So it was a really internal feeling. My wife says that it was a very therapeutic thing for me to write the book, but actually I didn't start off doing it in that way or start off with that as my intended goal. I felt like I'd got something to say. So actually looking back on it, and it was now quite a few years ago that I started and indeed got it out there only recently, but actually it has over time become very clear that it was a really useful thing for me to try and write down all the bits of it to help me process it. So it was a very cathartic thing in the end, I'm sure.
And I'm just thinking, how does this differ from your understanding of grief as a GP and a human being? I know you're your own person, but obviously you've probably come across... Hello, I can see you now.
Oh, we can see you all of a sudden. That's so exciting.
Curiously clicking in the background, trying to make it work. There we go.
Oh. obviously, you know, you're kind of... seeing death and grief I'm sure in your kind of like daily life as a GP, but kind of what did you discover about the nature of grief during this experience of losing your brother are you a father or are you as a husband?
So I've got three kids and a wife and a very responsible job. And I guess that I felt like I was really well prepared for going into hospital where I saw my brother die, being ready for the different stages of grief you have to contend with. And yet all of that was totally hopeless. I didn't, my family also, you think that they'll be good at helping you, but they're all in the same boat, so they were rubbish. You know, it's surprising that you think I've got a very close family. We're big and supportive. But actually, when they're all grieving too, it really doesn't help. And in fact, watching them grieving is even harder to contend with because you're hurting for their hurt. And round you go. You know, there are whirlpools of grief to explore when you're in a big family. And that was a huge part of what I wasn't expecting, a huge part of what I wasn't ready for. And I think that, as you say, writing it down has been helpful. Talking about it has been really helpful. Learning how bad I was at processing it before probably has been useful. And I think I'm a much better doctor now. I've asked my patients that. But it certainly opened my eyes to all sorts of things that I didn't expect to understand as well as I do now. So it's been a long process. And I'm much better now than I was back 6 years ago when Matt died. But it definitely improved me as a human, I hope. Is that a rather grim thing to say? After
no, not at all. It would be a lie to say that we are the same person now as we were before we've lost someone. I just think that what we learn is incredible. But do you think you've become more empathetic? Like, how would you describe the difference in kind of, you're saying how you are as a GP?
Yeah, I guess I think I'm more accepting of the different ways that people approach it because I've always been surprised at how varied people are within this world. And I think grief is a unique experience and it's got lots of common things, but actually just accepting that everybody goes through a different thing. And actually that's been a very useful lesson. I think asking people directly about it has been a very good thing for my career, you know, practicing as a GP, because it's such a unique thing and so many people have so many different perspectives and good understanding of it. Actually, when you ask them about it, they come out with great pearls of wisdom, which is why I think we should all be talking about it more. And I'm sure you agree with that. Otherwise, you wouldn't be doing what you're doing.
Nah, we don't want to talk about it. We don't really like talking about grief. Not interested. you mentioned that obviously having a different understanding as a GP. I wonder, like, with the theory of grief and how it as a general practitioner or as a medical human, how did the theory of what you experienced as grief actually compare to the actual experience of grief? Because obviously we know what grieving is like, but we also don't, we've never had the theory of
the model.
The model of it. Was it shocking compared to what you expected?
Good question. My experience was of sudden grief. So I didn't, you know, I'd seen Matt 2 days before he died and he was in a really good place. And so this was part of what I found so hard was this wasn't a planned death. It wasn't an expected death. It wasn't something that we could have predicted or been able to see. And so my experience is very much of that. Oh my God, this thing's happened to me that's thrown me into a total spin. And so within that context, it was a real shock. And I think that was part of what was quite so hard about it was I felt like what I'd learned about was a very stepwise progression through different stages of grief. Everybody knows this usual 7 stages of grief and you go through different ones and then you move to the next one. And finally you come out the other side of the graph at acceptance. And I am now at acceptance, having gone through all those processes. But I think what I discovered along the way that it's like a washing machine in the grief phase of all the different bits of emotion, that each of those things happens all at the same time, often several times a day. And part of the horror for me was waking up in the morning, remembering that Matt had died, and then having to go back through the whole cycle again. And so whilst it is very true that you experience these strange things, it's not true that it happens in an obvious, logical, linear way. And I think my scientific brain found that hard to contend with, but it was such a visceral experience, I think, and such a roller coaster. I know that's a commonly used word for processing grief, but it really did feel like that. And I think that's been a useful thing to discover, because it really helps me to talk to patients about death, or talk to my family, talk to everybody, because it's not just about patients. I think this is a very human thing, isn't it? It's not just my work. It's about life in general.
And I think it sets up unrealistic expectations for someone who's just lost someone to go, okay, yeah. So here we go, step one. Yeah. And actually, we're still revisiting things like stage two now. Yeah. And, you know, it's six, for you, how many years has it been since your mum died?
I mean, like 18.
18. Yeah. So it's just, there's no right or wrong, and there's no rule book.
Yeah. I think the comment about logic is really interesting as well, because, you know, I feel that very viscerally, that like logic gets thrown out the window, and that can be in a lot of ways really hard to contend with. And you've mentioned on top of that that you've kind of mentioned that the book is a love story for your brother Matt, and I wonder if there's like a reflection or a lesson that you want to be taken away from his experience or from your experience in the book.
I guess one of the things that also happens in grief and talking about death is this focus on the miserable and the morbid. And the funeral was a very serious thing because we wanted to get it all right, and we want to do it right and say the right things and have the right things there. And yet a huge part of what I found about wanting to celebrate Matt's life was to look at all the great things and look at all the lovely things that he had left, and to celebrate the positivity that he had had, or the joy or the wonder and all those bits that he brought that weren't morbid or sad. And I think for me, that was one of the things that I wanted to write about. And so in essence, I've punctuated the sad story of the sudden loss and going to the hospital and the funeral and all of that bit of it with elements of him talking to my kids or going out to play a tennis match with my son. And, you know, the joy of them laughing at everybody as they were around, you know, around them and giggling just in this intimate moment between my daughter and my brother, and those little flashes of joy that are so powerful in family life but are so often forgotten when you are remembering somebody, because it becomes so serious so quickly.
Yeah, absolutely.
And for me, those little moments of light or joy are something that, little snippets that you've got to really hang on to remember somebody by.
Absolutely. And all the proceeds from the book are being donated to the, is it the Wiltshire and Bath and Air Ambulance?
Wiltshire Air Ambulance, who came on the fateful day, so they were very much in the process, and that's been a thing to collect some money for. So I hope that we can make some money off the book sale, so that I can give some money back to something that tried to do its best. And I think that that's a really important charity. So it's nice to be able to give something back in that sense. But
Absolutely,
that's what proceeds from the book are going to that.
Tom, thank you so much for sharing all of that, and we'll definitely share the book on our socials. Yeah. I really look forward to reading it as well. I know Tasha's already dived in to have a read, but I'm definitely going to do that. But thank you so much. Is there anything, kind of the final words that you want to share? Anything that you want to let listeners know about, maybe, I don't know, one lesson you've learned from writing the book, or anything you think people should know about grief?
Yeah, well, thank you. And it's been great to chat. I think for me, the key thing is to live life to the full. I know that's such an obvious cliche, and you do come round to cliches a lot when you're grieving, because they actually make sense. Time is a healer, although people don't say 2 years is a very long time to wait to feel any better. You know what I mean? Those platitudes are really important. And for me, remembering that life can be very fleeting and very short, and to focus on the really important stuff, have perspective, make sure you're doing the right thing by you and your family, because there isn't a second chance at it.
Incredible.
Love that. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Tom.
Take care.
Thank you so much.
Bye.
Thank you.
Bye.
Ugh. I actually, I'm not going to lie.
Yeah.
Today might have restored me a little.
Oh, good.
I feel quite cheery about all that.
I think I feel like I should write stuff down, because I feel like every guest that we have that's coming on
tells us to write everything down.
No.
Oh.
No, everyone is kind of saying the same thing. And I feel like maybe we should write a book about everything we've learned from all these people, because I just feel there's so much wisdom and advice. And I think he's bang on, these cliches. They're a cliche for a reason. And like...
I just broke something. I just was holding something and I broke it, and I'm sad about it.
And Hefzibah obviously said about, you know, grief being embodied in you and needing to be released through movement and creativity. Yep. And I mean, that's exactly what Stuart from BreathPod was saying.
Absolutely.
And
we've had so many people come on and just be like, guys,
feel it.
And also, but live your life.
And live your life.
This is why Becky and I, are you gonna come work at mine tomorrow? We're gonna body double and do some little. We can write our journals together.
Oh, yeah. No, we do need to do that. We do need just sit and
maybe that's
process.
What we should do. We should do like a little memories. Actually, I've been keeping a scrap journal, which I highly recommend. I just got one of those little gluey mice, you know, the ones that you just little glue across the page. And then I've been collecting trash and then just sticking it in a book.
Well, I think what we should do when we only have one guest one day,
I would
maybe
recommend.
We can put all of our thoughts together and chat about them.
Yep.
But for now, we're off to see a play tomorrow.
Oh my gosh, we're going to go see Sad Book from our guest Andrea.
So we'll debrief.
So we will tell you all about that next week.
Debrief next week.
And yeah, we are. What a nice thing to be back together. Love you.
Yeah, love you, Tash.
No, love you more. Shut
see up. You next week, 5 p.m.
I guess so.
Bye.
Bye.